Good afternoon. My name is Susan Muirhead, and today I'll be reading part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, March 17th, 2026. I believe this is also St. Patrick's Day, so happy St. Patrick's Day. Let's begin with today's top stories. The first headline reads, Front Page Opinion, an opinion article by Jim Dye. J-I-M, last name D-E-Y. Ex-chancellor, professor deserves second chance. Original tenure process allegedly tainted by politics. This article is based out of Urbana. A University of Illinois architecture professor challenging his denial of tenure has gained some powerful support in his effort to win a second outside review of his qualifications. But despite that, Benjamin Bross, B-R-O-S-S, said right now, quote unquote, nothing has changed in his effort to reverse his status. Former Chancellor Richard Herman recently added his name to a list of Bross faculty supporters who are urging top U of I officials to grant Bross a second tenure review, this one conducted by experts not affiliated with the U of I. Herman said, what occasions this letter is that we have learned of disturbing procedural violations, previously unknown to us, that undermine the fundamental fairness of Bross's 2024 tenure review process. The letter was signed by Herman, as well as retired and current faculty members, Carrie Nelson, Jacqueline Ross, Richard Ross, and Helene Silverman. The U of I's Faculty Advisory Committee, citing procedural irregularities in the Bross review, previously recommended that Bross receive a second tenure review, but the committee's recommendation is not binding on university administrators. Bross's termination was previously scheduled for the end of the current academic year, but he was granted an additional year because of the slow pace of his tenure appeal, meaning he is scheduled to remain on the faculty until August 17, 2027. At the same time, however, Bross said a report prepared by the Office for Access and Equity did not support his claim that he was a victim of anti-Jewish discrimination by the faculty members who oversaw the initial tenure review and Bross's appeal. Bross has alleged he is a victim of anti-Jewish bias that can be attributed to his public stance in support of Israel in the aftermath of Hamas's October 2023 attack on Israel. Roughly 1,200 people were killed and dozens of others taken hostage by Hamas soldiers. Worldwide reaction to the surprise attack filtered down to the U of I campus, where protests supporting both Israel and Palestinians occurred. Faculty members on both sides of the debate participated in the extremely emotional scrum, which was highlighted by mostly student protesters setting up a pro-Palestinian campsite near the Union. In addition to the promotion and tenure committee failing to follow its own rules, the Herman letter charged that its members had conflicts of interest, in particular dislike of Bross's open and public support of Israel that infected the process. The Herman letter said reviewers downplayed or disregarded all of the various positive letters and evaluation of Bross's work, while one negative external letter was left standing, and that proved decisive, quote unquote. The U of I has steadfastly and repeatedly declined comment on the Bross controversy. Individual faculty reviewers of his tenure also have declined to respond to inquiries. The Herman letter said members of the Bross Review Committee included several intellectually and politically committed anti-Zionists, citing as examples committee chair Terry Weissman and faculty member D. Fairchild Ruggles. Noting that Bross was commended in his third-year review for doing a remarkable job, the letter's authors challenged the credibility of the tenure denial. In its tenure denial notice to Bross, the review committee justified its decision by saying his work was, quote-unquote, lacking magnitude and impact. The appeal committee did the same. Jim Dye is a staff writer for the News Gazette. His email, you can reach him by email at jdey@newsgazette.com. Next up, CU Schools Foundation Awards, part 1 of 5. This is the beginning article in a series. True Grit. Two proud Maroons turned business partners to be honored for giving back to alma mater. This article is written by Luke Taylor, who can be reached by email at ltaylor@newsgazette.com. This article is based out of Champaign. Central High School has changed a lot since the alumni who would become the founders of Grit Automation received their diplomas, and today they're proud to say they contributed to those changes. Joel Danovitz and Marco Nieto weren't friends in school. In fact, they graduated around a decade apart from each other, never overlapping. They connected as adults when they became neighbors, and they never looked back. "You guys came over for dinner one night," Danowitz said of Nieto and his wife. "And then I don't think that you've left since." And this is Danowitz, D-A-N-O, Dano, W-I-T-Z, and Marco Nieto, N-I-E-T-O. Both consider themselves tinkerers, guys who like having a problem to work on, big or small. They worked on all kinds of projects, as minor as small repairs and as major as kitchen renovations, though they figure they'd still be working on a beer delivery system via drone if the idea for Grit hadn't come up first. Some of their work with Grit, G-R-I-T, which provides safety automation to workshops and machine shops, made its high school debut at Central. Now Danowitz and Nieto are set to be recognized next month with a Local Business Community Impact Award from the CU Schools Foundation. Nieto never took shop back in high school, but Danowitz did. He remembers it as a favorite class, especially thanks to a teacher he's still trying to track down to catch up with today by the name of Edward Nyman. Nyman went out of his way, spending money from his own pocket to buy a router so that Danowitz would be able to complete a project he was working on in class. "I needed to cut an inlay into the top of this table, but the shop didn't have that tool, so he went and bought this nice plunger router, and then kept it locked up so that other people didn't use it," Danowitz said, "just because I was good at workshop." For his part, Nieto has a hard time putting a finger on a specific instructor who left a major impact on him, partly because he says he had a lot of great teachers who all offered different kinds of support and education. "All of them were so different from each other, and I just got different things from them," he said. "At that time, you're a high school kid. You're more worried about, what am I doing after school? What are my friends up to?" Another thing Danowitz remembers about shop class is how dangerous it could be. He was present when a classmate with special needs, whose usual aid wasn't present, turned on a saw, made a mistake in the cutting process, and ended up with a serious injury that permanently reduced the function of his arm. It was a graphic scene, to put it lightly. "Talk about life-altering events," Danowitz said. "If a system like ours existed back then, which obviously it didn't due to the technology available, that very likely wouldn't have happened," Nieto said. Witnessing something like that left an impression on Danowitz. When he saw his son nearly take a similar risk, he took it very seriously. His young 5-year-old son at the time was in his home garage and went to a joiner, which is a pretty dangerous machine. "There's a big green button on it," he goes, and presses it, and this thing just whirls up," Nieto recalled. Joel had his back turned, and it scared the living crap out of him. Fortunately, Danowitz's son wasn't hurt at all by the machine, but it was still a jarring moment. Nieto and Danowitz immediately put their heads together. They'd found a new problem to tinker with, and it was a big one. How can we stop anyone, but especially kids, from getting hurt by this kind of dangerous machinery? That question led to a deceptively straightforward-sounding answer: stop them from being able to turn on that machinery without express permission. Creating that control and placing it in the hands of shop teachers or manufacturing plant managers or home workshop owners is what Grit is all about. Imagine a wood shop or a machine shop where you have dangerous tools like table saws, jointers, planers, etc. "We can control access to those tools and sort of lock them down," Nieto said. "If you go up to a tool and turn it on, nothing's going to happen." That's a very simplified explanation of the concept he and Danowitz created. Danowitz has professional history as a software architect, which he was able to apply to the ideas as both partners learn more about the hardware aspects of technology together. The system they designed allows existing machinery to be fitted with devices that essentially lock the machines and require the appropriate key to turn them on. In this case, the key can be a card or an individual's phone that has to be scanned by that device. This gives one individual, such as a shop teacher, the ability to allow and disallow specific people to use specific devices. The system has also led to numerous other applications. For example, it automated the process of turning on dust collection vacuums with the GRIT system. People can set up the entire dust collection system to turn on when a device that creates dust turns on. Without that, they'd have to do so manually. It's efficient and it makes you actually use your dust collection as it should be, Nieto said. That sort of brings health to you because you're not kicking up these fine dust particles and breathing them in. In a classroom application, though, it means that a teacher can control students' access to machinery based on each individual and their ability and trustworthiness. The first group to try the system after Nieto and Danowitz created it was the Champaign Woodworkers Club. Next, a shop manager at the University of Illinois' School of Architecture saw it and immediately wanted to give it a try. GRIT has spread to other universities across the U.S. and even into Canada and Australia, but getting into high school-level shop courses was always a goal. What better place to take it first than their alma mater? GRIT Automation found its way into a high school-level classroom for the first time at Central about 2 years ago. It was nice to say, you know what? We'll just give you the system, Nieto said. In turn, it gives us some good feedback, and we get to do something for our old high school. The two proud Maroons said it was good to get back into the school for the first time since they each graduated and see how things have changed. Nieto said he liked seeing everything from major renovations at the school, one of which was a brand new shop with new equipment that GRIT got to settle in with. It was a cool blast from the past to go in there, Danowitz said. If you want to talk about the feel-good story of it, that's it. We build things that help keep kids safe. And there's three or four that accompany this article. First, there's a shot of two men in just a general photo of them in the shop. The caption reads, Joel Danowitz and Marco Nieto, owners of GRIT Automation, are being recognized by the CU Foundation, Schools Foundation, with this year's Local Business Community Impact Award. Their company specializes in safety procedures and software for workshops. Locally, the Central High School graduates donated and installed a $41,000 state-of-the-art workshop safety system to their alma mater. And that photo is taken by Rob Lacates of the News Gazette. And he also took these other photos. One is of a man, glasses, medium build, Caucasian, talking in front of a machine. And the caption reads, Marco Nieto, co-owner of Champaign's GRIT Automation, demonstrates Thursday afternoon how someone can use the company's technology to lock down all the power tools in a workshop at the press of a button. And there's also kind of smaller photos, and one is kind of a key card that's got take control at the top of it, and then a G, and then GRIT. It's just like a credit card, and the front and back of it, and you can see that there's a way to swipe the card. The caption reads, Joel Danowitz demonstrates how GRIT Automation's key card system works. At Central High School, each student has key card access that allows them to use equipment with teacher permission. And as a follow-up, honor roll. Between now and the CU Foundation's April 10th Distinguished Alumni Honoree Reception, we'll profile this year's winners and chat with each of them on News Gazette Radio, powered by GTP's insurance, the Fab 5R. Jonathan Butler DePlessis, Central Distinguished Alumni. Ayala Donshin, Urbana Distinguished Alumni, Andy Whitford, Centennial Distinguished Alumni, Tracy Parsons, Local Hero, and the Grit Automation Local Business Community Impact Award winner. Congratulations to all of those recipients. Next up, episode 40, as heard on, airing from 4 to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday on WDWS 1400 AM and streaming online at newsgazette.com. Here's like a highlight of two stories. First up, Shauna Cooper Whitehead. Shauna Cooper Whitehead's path to the presidency at Denver's Regis University was paved in CU by parents who raised me to try to help people and by a certain Holy Cross teacher who helped sell her on a future in the education business. You know, there are a lot of stereotypes about nuns out there, whether it be in the media or what you see on TV, and I was terrified to have Sister Thomas on my third grade teacher when I got my assignment, Cooper Whitehead said on Monday's 40th edition of News Gazette Radio, powered by GTP's insurance. I was worried. I was like, is she going to be mean? Are we going to get in trouble? And to say that she was the funnest, the most hilarious, the kindest teacher that I ever had in elementary school is truly an understatement. It was her that kind of brought me around to thinking about I could be a teacher. If I could be like Sister Thomas, that's what I would do. 4 decades later, the Holy Cross, Urbana High School, and University of Illinois College of Education alumna made history last week when she was named the 29th president and first female to lead Regis, R-E-G-I-S, a 150-year-old private Jesuit university. She'll finish out 2025-26 at Boston College, where she's in her fifth year as VP of Student Affairs, following stops at Seton Hall, Loyola of Chicago, the University of Illinois, Northwestern, MIT, and Boston U. I've really found a home in Catholic higher education, said Cooper Whitehead, who also spoke of the impact the late Mildred Barnes Griggs, the U of I College of Education's first Black dean, had on her own professional outlook, saying, I didn't know folks who looked like me could rise to that level. Next up, Verdell Jones III is trading his seat on a champagne fire truck for one of seven on the Urbana City Council. Monday marked the former Central basketball star's final day as a member of the fire department and first official meeting as the new alderman representing Urbana's Ward 4. The things that I've seen and experienced responding to 911 calls with CFD, it's kind of disheartening as a firefighter. I always felt like I was playing a reactive role. You call us when the bees has hit the fan, Jones said. I want to be on the other side. I want to be more proactive, whether it's with our youth, whether it's with the homeless situation. You can't really make change unless you have a seat at the table. You can march all you want, but unless you have a seat at the table and can help really direct some of those changes, then things will continue to be the same. And lastly, there was no transfer portal back in 2002 when Jack Ingram followed coach Bill Self from Tulsa to Illinois, a move that meant sitting out a full season. But 21 years after helping Self's Illini secure a spot in the national championship game, the 2005 Big Ten Medal of Honor winner is happy switching schools no longer is happy. Switching schools no longer comes with such a harsh penalty. I like it, Ingram said. Giving players the ability to make their college career their own and giving them that power is something that makes college basketball better. I think the turnover and players finding the spots that fit them the best allows fans to have hope because you're one good transfer away from being right back in it. And these highlights were compiled by Jeff D'Alessio for the News Gazette. Next up, top of the morning. Something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. And remember, comments, questions, suggestions for Top of the Morning, you can always reach out to Jim Rosso at his email address. He can be reached at jrossow@newsgazette.com. The Illini's late season hiccup played out in Richard Carlson's favor. falling to a number 3 seed, sent Brad Underwood's team to Greenville, South Carolina, where Richard and his wife, Kathy, moved from Urbana in 2020. The Rantoul High grad, class of 1971, will be in the stands with his daughter visiting from the University of Illinois, College of Education's Amanda Brown, for Thursday's and Saturday's games, having purchased tickets weeks ago. At that time, Illinois was slotted in St. Louis. I checked Joe Lenardi's bracket over the weekend, and I got excited, Richard said. I've been an Illini fan forever. He's not kidding. Richard attended 271 consecutive Illini home football games from 1975 to 2019. A resident of nearby Pelzer, Richard said Illini fans will enjoy Greenville. His tourist tips? Bond Secure Wellness Arena is comparable to State Farm Center. Must-sees: Falls Park on the Reedy, Liberty Bridge over the falls, and close to the bridge is a very unique Medusa tree. Downtown Main Street is tree-lined with a variety of restaurants, bars, and specialty shops. We like Mass General Store, River Street Suites, and Northgate Soda Shop. Fluor Field, F-L-U-O-R, Field, home of the Greenville Drive minor league baseball team, is next to Shoeless Joe Jackson Museum. He was from Greenville and played local ball here. Mountain sites like Caesar's Head Outlook and Bald Rock Heritage Preserve Outlook are nearby. Furman University has a beautiful campus. Cancer Survivors Park is close to downtown, and Swamp Rabbit Trail is popular with walkers and joggers. The city is really clean, the architecture is nice, and everyone's super friendly, Richard said. Next up, history. Area history. In 1926, a truce was declared today between Urbana Mayor W.F. Burrs and the proprietors of the Princess and Colonial Theaters, whose licenses were reinstated on the condition that the theaters stay closed on Sundays until the city election on April 30th, when voters will decide the issue. With both theaters dark last night, downtown Urbana took on the appearance of a deserted village where the sight of more than 3 men and a dog on Main Street was something to boast about. In 1976, former Champaign Mayor Virgil Wyckoff and Urbana Attorney Timothy B. Johnson easily won the Republican nomination for state representative in the 52nd District. In November, they will vie with two Democrats, Helen Satterthwaite of Urbana and Scott Shearer of Villa Grove, for 3 seats in the Illinois House. Satterthwaite is the only incumbent. In 2011, a bill that would have abolished the 50% tuition waivers that go to the children of public university employees is on hold after opponents included what the sponsor called a poison pill, quote unquote. Senate Minority Leader Christine Rodogno, representative from Lamont, decided to avoid a full Senate Executive Committee vote on the legislation after committee members voted down an amendment that would have allowed current employees to continue to enjoy the benefit. But the committee then voted to adopt a second Rodogno requested amendment to ban the long controversial General Assembly scholarships. The next headline reads, City of Paxton, first TIF, T-I-F district, eclipses $1 million mark. This article is written by Will Brumleave from Ford County Chronicle and is based out of Paxton. More than midway through its 23-year lifespan, Paxton's first tax increment financing district achieved a long-awaited milestone in fiscal year 2025, finally eclipsing the $1 million mark in tax increment generated by property improvements downtown and along West Ottawa Road around the Interstate 57 interchange. The $319,070 in tax increment brought into the city's special tax allocation fund last fiscal year, which began May 1, 2024 and ended April 30, 2025, pushed the 13-year total for the TIF district since its establishment in 2012 to $1,220,798, according to city attorney Tony Schuring. That's S-C-H-U-E-R-I-N-G. Tony Schuring highlighted that fact, among others, while reviewing the TIF district's annual report for last fiscal year during a meeting of the TIF district's Joint Review Board on March 10th at City Hall. He did so again later that evening during the City Council's monthly meeting, too. "We're in a really good position with the TIF," Schuring told Alderman. Schuring also noted that the tax increment generated in fiscal year 2025 increased substantially by more than $106,000 from the $212,292 in revenue collected in fiscal year 2024. "It was just a very good year overall for the TIF," Schuring said. "The TIF district is also generating more interest than in past years," Schuring added, noting that the $4,566 in interest generated in fiscal year 2025 is up slightly from the $4,475 generated the previous fiscal year and makes up almost half of the $9,341 brought in overall. The revenue figures for last fiscal year compare with expenses of $173,626 incurred, resulting in a net income of $150,011 and a year-end fund balance of $268,812, up from a starting balance of $118,801, Schuring said. Expenses included $664 in recording costs for redevelopment agreements, $1,242 paid in property tax reimbursements to landowners who agreed to have their properties annexed into the city when the TIF district was created, $8,174 in professional services costs, $39,029 in property assembly and site preparation costs, and $124,517 in building renovation and rehabilitation costs as paid out to property owners and contractors. Payments of $10,000 or more were listed in Schuring's annual report, showing $39,029 to Paxton Hotel Group, LLC, the developer of the Cobblestone Hotel and Suites on West Ottawa Road, along with payments to three contractors that performed work as part of redevelopment projects within the TIF district, $23,787 to Eagle Painting, $12,214 to Bacon and Van Buskirk, and $10,761 to Horns Construction. Also listed were payments of $10,000 each to Courtney Bowes, Cadillac LLC, and Paxton Washburn LLC, all of which opted for longer-term paychecks, quote-unquote, for improvements to their respective properties, Schuring said. As the end of the last fiscal year, the city still owed $1,255,220 in payments to property owners as obligated via redevelopment agreements, Schuring said. "That number obviously is extremely high. We're now far enough into the TIF that I think we can say with some confidence that we're likely not going to generate that level of increment within the TIF," Schuring said. And that's from around the area. My name is Susan Muirhead, and this has been part one of the News Gazette, dated for this date, Tuesday, March 17th, 2026. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I'll be back in a moment to read part two of the News Gazette, so please stay with me. It's always a pleasure to read with you. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day.